You're listening to Face Off, episode 34, recorded September 12th, 2009. Welcome to Face Off, your face-to-face web technology podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Jade Robbins.
And I'm Mark Sanborn.
And in this podcast, we talk about various aspects of web technology, such as web development, social media, and web entrepreneurship. As always, you can view our show notes by going to faceoffshow.com or follow us by going to twitter.com/faceoffshow.
Yep.
All right, Mark. So another week, another Face Off. How are things going?
It's going good.
Good.
Summer is near its end.
And yeah, I know. There's some people around the neighborhood have been barbecuing a lot more than normal, I think, because they're trying to get out there sort of like last barbecues before the summer ends.
It's gonna get cold.
But hey, I got a joke for you.
What's that?
How many programmers does it take to change a light bulb?
How many?
None. That's a hardware problem. Yuck, 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 yuck. And is this thing on? Hello?
So, yeah, we don't like hardware problems as programmers.
No, I've always been a person that doesn't like to deal with hardware much. I've always talked about this with like especially when it's like Linux. Yeah. I love tinkering with the software and all the things it has to do within it, programming, web programming. When it like interacting, especially with the software and hardware, like dealing with the hardware at all, I absolutely hate. I don't like doing any of it at all. Like, so yeah,
like a webcam or something doesn't work, or the sound on your laptop.
That's actually weird because just this second ago, earlier today, Mark and I both have HP netbooks.
Mine's a slightly different model than yours.
Yours is a different model, but ever since we've both got them and installed Ubuntu on them, the speakers don't work. The headphone jack does. Mm-hmm. But you know, we were both kind of like, oh, that's okay.
It's kind of a known bug though. I searched it out a little bit and you had searched it out a little bit and, you can get, they claim you can get it to work if you do some things, but I never put enough effort into it to really do anything. But yours, it just started working.
Yeah. Today before the show, I ran updates on all my computers so that we didn't have, you know, like first of all, you have to run updates on our Mac that's recording because it'll pop up in the middle of the show.
Oh,
and like
make noise.
But so I ran updates on my netbook and, we were goofing off on some web page that had an ad with sound on it and my speakers just started working apparently after the update.
Thank God for those ads.
But not you. That's the funny part.
Mine doesn't work.
But see, it's problems like that. Anyways, problems like that I hate. Where, like you said, you know, there's solutions, but you have to go and change all this stuff. Mm-hmm. I don't. I really call myself Captain Vanilla, and it's very true. I don't like to goof stuff up because what I've done in the past is when I have to go through in Linux and like hack around stuff to make something work, later they fix it and then it doesn't work then. And it's like you end up just reinstalling every time. It just drives me nuts.
I think that's the whole Windows operating system is built on that. We've got a bug. Let's make a little patch. And then they like base their entire business off this little patch and then it just becomes a big mess.
I don't know what that has to do with Windows. I think you're stretching here. You hate Windows.
Okay. News and follow-ups.
I can't blame you. You run a website called NixTutor. But anyways, yeah, I hate little problems like that with Linux. And it was just really bizarre that who knows how long the speaker's been working and I haven't gone to a website with a Win and Nintendo Wii ad in a while. So, Anyways, let's get into our news and follow-ups. Our first follow-up is in episode 33, we talked about five things that can kill your websites. And one of the things that can kill your website was time-based bugs. We talked a lot about like the Zune problem. We talked a lot about daylight savings time stuff is time-based problems. Well, there's apparently another kind of odd one out there. What is it?
Apparently, there's a bug that was filed in the Ubuntu bug tracker that you can't print Epson printers on Tuesdays. Only on Tuesdays. Every other day you can print.
Yeah.
I thought that was really funny. And that's the type of bug that's just so hard to track down. Yeah. Like, it worked for me. Oh, it worked for me. Oh, it didn't work for me. You know, and you're like, what?
Well, then you're like, okay, why isn't it printing? And then the next day you're like, and it prints and you're like, oh I must have just done something goofy yesterday.
A week later you're trying to print and you're like, I am going crazy.
I mean, it's weird how they found this out. I mean, I wonder how much trial and error and how much user frustration must have gone into this because people were like, it doesn't print one day and it prints the next until you really make the correlation that it's always on Tuesdays. I mean, it must have been someone who has to print off a schedule or something every Tuesday that was like, no, this seriously doesn't work except for on Tuesdays.
Imagine something that like happened every like, I don't know, every 27th of odd months or something like crazy.
So these type of bugs, as we talked about, are hard to track down. Daylight savings time is sort of the obvious one, but you never know. I mean, what would have caused this? That, you know, I mean, is there some sort of math in the algorithm, and for some reason, you know, the number three breaks it because Tuesday is the third day of the week, you know, and it starts at zero. I don't know.
Yeah, so I mean, it's kind of like the Zune bug. They're like, oh, we forgot about leap years or, you know, whatever. And,
well, like I said, though, that's obvious. It was like, it was leap year, all the Zunes died. How do you start debugging that it doesn't print on Tuesdays in a printer driver? I mean, what? Mm-hmm. Where are you referencing the day in a printer driver at all?
It just makes it ridiculously hard to track down.
So try and think about things like that to get kind of swing back to the point. You got to make sure you just think about little things like that and test as often. Like we said, try and, you know, if you're doing a web app, set your system time to be, you know, the day before daylight savings time, or, you know, test it throughout the week to make sure that if some weird reason you are referencing a day or something, it doesn't break it.
The next news and follow-up we have is Estimix, I think is how you pronounce it. And this came in from a user of ours that sent in a comment, Aline S.
It's sort of, I can't remember what episode it was. We talked about all these ways like compete.com to go look at traffic and information about your competitors and yourself if you're popular enough. Well, what... Estimix. What it does is it does a lot of stuff that some of the other ones do, but the really cool part is it gives you sort of an estimated value of that website.
The value as far as how, like, many people there is?
Let's say if you were based on visitors, its URL, let's say if, you know, you've got like pizza.com, like we talked about, you know, that one's going to have a lot higher value just because of the domain itself, but how many visitors it has, you know, people going to it, how many links it has on the outside, and tries to give it sort of a dollar value. Again, I probably wouldn't make an offer to a company to purchase them based off this, but it's a good way to compare because it's using the same sort of heuristics to compare two things. So you can compare two different websites and get, you know, a relative value as to which one would be worth more than the other.
So what's kind of different? You know, it was episode 25 where we talked about like compete.com, Datopedia, Quantcast. How does this one, does this one actually give you a value? Like, we think this website's worth this much?
Like it says cool. And it's based off, so I found the list. It's based off the age of the website, the demographic structure of the traffic, the sources of traffic, such as search engines, social bookmarking, blogs, blah, blah, blah. The countries where the website is popular. So, like, if it's really popular in a really poor country, it's not going to be worth as much. Mm-hmm. And then sort of like the website niche, like if it's, you know, if the website's talking about really expensive jewelry and stuff, you have a lot of really, you know, wealthy people going to it, it's going to be worth more.
It's saying dig.com is worth 17 million.
Which is way off.
lower or higher?
I think higher.
Yeah.
They were rejecting offers much higher.
Well, let's see. Okay. Facebook, they rejected a $3.5 billion, right? Mm-hmm. They're saying $1 billion is worth.
Yeah. It actually might be now. Who knows? Yeah. But like I said, I wouldn't make an offer to buy a company out based on this.
But it's interesting to know.
But it's, again, it's a good way to look at one site and then go to the other on the same, on the same website and compare the two. So let's say, you know, because it's using the same heuristics against two different websites, so you can get a relative value. Like you could say, wow, okay, well, Facebook obviously is worth a lot more than Dig.
Interesting. Facebook purchased their domain from two cows.
Really?
That's crazy. It's always interesting to look at that kind of stuff.
Yeah, you never know. Because, I mean, maybe they purchased it a long time ago and just been renewing it at the same registrar.
Mm-hmm.
It'd be funny if they let their domain expire one day. Oh. Just that. Someone should get fired.
Yeah. They would be able to get it back, though.
Similar, though.
There's a time period.
There's been a couple Gmail outages. Mm-hmm. And it's funny to see when these big sort of internet... champions of the internet that, you know, just are always there and always working, like Google, Facebook. It's always funny when they go down. I actually had a tweet that I printed out, and it said, if we have a baby boom in 9 months from this month, we can blame Gmail.
It's funny. There are a lot of users that use Gmail.
Yeah.
I am one of them.
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, it's kind of like when... I'm sure I've told the story before, but when I used to work on campus, we had one of the few rooms that was power backup generated, and we were not really super essential employees, but just because of the way they structured offices, we had one that used to have really important stuff in it. So the power would go out And so me and my coworker would be doing sort of the same stupid stuff we would. And then we'd walk to get coffee. And all these people that were doing much more important stuff would be standing outside their office. It's always funny to see when the internet goes out or when the power goes out, like all these people just kind of stand outside and like they don't know what to do.
What do we
like,
do? And then the next day you get a flood of posts on what to do when the power goes out.
Yeah,
exactly. On the internet. Like, you can still, so because the Gmail bug, you couldn't go to the web interface, but the IMAP was still available.
IMAP
so.
Worked. You could still go to iGoogle and get to it because it went through the back end and stuff. But yeah, and it's funny. What's really funny about it, it was like a sort of web thing. It wasn't an infrastructure back end thing.
Mm-hmm.
So,
which is good. It's better.
So watch population statistics. If there's a baby boom in 9 months, I want to know. Because I blame Gmail. But check it out, estimix.com.
Yeah, so we'd like to thank Aline S. for sending that web app in. That was awesome.
Yeah, that was way awesome. I love that sort of things. All right, let's get into our web apps. Our first two web apps are kind of related. I don't know about you, but I'm kind of a goofball about the weather.
Really? I never look at it. I don't know.
That's funny. I think it's because you drive to work, even though record to our listeners, you live a block away from your job. You still drive every day.
Two blocks.
I walk about a quarter mile. So the weather is kind of important. So I get up every morning and I looked at the day by day hour forecast from weather.com, and I have like these web apps to help me out. And you know, I have an umbrella, and sometimes it'll be just kind of sprinkling out and I'll have my umbrella and everybody looks at me like I'm a weirdo and stuff. But and I have little weather stations around the house and stuff. So,
what's the weather going to be tomorrow?
I have no idea.
Are you
it's day by day. I do it every morning.
Okay.
And it's the weekend. What do I care on the weekend? But the next two apps are kind of a way to help you figure out how to do it. They're the world's simplest weather forecasters. You know, some people want to go look, you know, if you're Hank Hill, you want to know the dew point, but if you're just like most people, you want to know whether or not you need a coat and whether or not you need an umbrella. So the first app tells you whether or not you need an umbrella. It's called Umbrella Today. It's, you know, touts itself as the world's simplest weather report. Just tells you if you need an umbrella or not, which is nice. So you go in, put in your zip code, and it says, hey, you're gonna need an umbrella today.
That's, yeah, I mean, not everybody lives in a place where it's gonna snow or blow or go, you know, all they want to know is, do I need to, you know, where am I, you know, bring an umbrella or whatever.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, even in, you know, the lower states, there's going to be rain, and you want to know whether, but yeah, if like you're up here in Montana, umbrella today, you're going to use it a lot more, especially in the winter, because you want to know if it's going to snow out. Cause like if you walk, for me, when it's dumping here in Montana, dumping snow out, and I don't have an umbrella, like I'll get to work and my head is soaked and like my bag with my computer in it is wet. So, it's useful. You really put in your zip code, hit submit, and it tells you whether or not you need an umbrella. They have some other services, like supposedly they have an SMS service so that you can sign up and have it like send to your text your cell phone every morning need an umbrella.
Yeah,
but I couldn't get it to work.
Really?
I signed up for it, and there's been a couple days I know where it should have told me to bring an umbrella, and it didn't. So I'm not sure if the SMS is working or not.
See, that part of the app would make it super useful. I mean, I don't really want to go to this site every single day and check it, but I would be great to have a text message that says, hey, you should probably have an umbrella today.
I know. Like, we've well established chance that you're lazy.
Well, I think other people are lazy,
I wonder
too.
If there's, like, Umbrella Today iGoogle apps. That would be useful if you have iGoogle.
Are you sure when you signed up or whatever and did your SMS that it was verified properly and everything?
Yeah. Twice.
Three? Still nothing?
Maybe three times. I do things a lot.
Okay.
No, I don't know. Check it out. It could be, you never know. It could be a Verizon thing. I have like premium text messages disabled, so Verizon might think it's a premium text message. I don't know. But either way, I could never get the SMS to work, but it's useful. So, here's the deal. I get up every morning and I look at weather.com. And the whole point is, if you're that type of person, but you don't really want the hour by hour weather, you just want to know whether or not you get an umbrella, get up in the morning and do that instead.
So let's say I don't know, it doesn't rain much. I don't really care. I don't really have an umbrella, but I want to know if I can wear my short sleeves or.
Well, here's the thing. Let's say you have an umbrella and Umbrella Today tells you that you need to bring an umbrella, but you step outside in shorts and a t-shirt and it's, you know, negative 10 outside. That's not very useful.
Right.
So our next web app, which is called Sleeves at gotsleeves.com or gotsleeves.appspot.com, my apologies, tells you what length of sleeve you need to wear for the day.
So we got both things covered.
Yeah, exactly.
You need to wear a big coat.
Yeah, it's cold. You know, I mean, people, I know what people are going to say. Why don't you just step outside and look up at the sky and see what the temp? Well, that's fine. But, and a lot of people, let's say they live in California, the weather is fairly consistent. Mm-hmm. People like us live in Montana. And I mean, it will change in an 8-hour period.
Montana, like, still holds the record for the highest temperature change, or the most temperature changed in one day.
Variance in one day. Yep. Yeah. And so
I think it was over 100 degrees.
And then where did it go down to?
Negative something. It was like 80 or 70, and it went to negative something.
Yeah, because it's weird. We're kind of on this sort of pressure ridge line where you can get this really cold Canadian air or this really warm southern air, and it can flip-flop really quickly. So using these two web apps, you should be, you know, good to know. And especially if you live in Montana, you know, because it will change. But there's a lot of places where it'll look warm, and in a period of 4 to 5 hours, it can get really rainy.
So, the greatest temperature change in 24 hours occurred in Loma, Montana, on January 15, 1972. The temperature was 103 degrees, and then went to negative 54 degrees. God. Oh, my God.
Did anybody survive that?
Wow. That's really? Amazing. Is that even possible?
Yeah.
It's crazy. And then they have, like, the second place, which was in Montana as well. No. Browning. And then third place was Fairfield, Montana, and then South Dakota.
Yeah.
Wow. So that is crazy.
That's why you got to be tough to live here.
Yep.
It's not, you know, it ain't no wussy state.
So will this just say I need to wear long sleeves, or will it say kind of like you need to beef up?
I'm not certain, to be honest with you.
Okay.
It's cute though. When you go to it and you put in your stuff, it shows a hand.
Yeah, it's very simple.
Then you ask it which length of sleeve to have, and it like slides over like you got a really big long hand with sleeves on it and stuff. So I don't know. You should like put in Antarctica and see.
What's the zip code for Antarctica?
I don't know. What is the zip code for Antarctica? It'd be an international postal code.
This one doesn't look like it does have like a text message system to it. It's more of a you go there and check it out. But
again, some cute little fun weather apps. Maybe later on we'll get to some more advanced weather apps for the power user. Maybe that's what I should do. I should ask Super User, which was an app we talked about last time,
what
the best power user weather applications are. But anyways, that's Umbrella Today and gotsleeves.appspot.com. So check them out.
Wait. I have a zip code for Antarctica here.
No way.
Man, this might not work. This might be fail. Let me try it.
We stand waiting anxiously.
Never mind. Okay.
What did it say?
It said error.
It's like
I think it was one of those wiki answers. This we talked about this. Like Super User is a great system because you can downvote like an answer, where wiki answers, the first person that, you know, votes or whatever goes in there, they get the answer. And somebody asks, yeah, what's the quote, you know, does Antarctica have a zip code? And somebody said yes, it's 672.
Silly. That's definitely not, because it would have to be an international postal code, because I don't
well
think,
yeah. I mean, zip codes are specific to the United States, and then there's postal codes for Canada, and the other countries use different systems. But
so today, the calculated sleeveage is short for Montana. It's looking good outside.
But you might have to wear a parka later this afternoon.
Well, I'm assuming this is a good point, too. I'm assuming these web apps are smart enough to, like, look at the whole day. I know Umbrella Today is. The whole point of Umbrella Today is, are you going to need an umbrella today? And if you know, even if like at 5 o'clock it rains, you're going to need your umbrella.
But I don't think any app could have predicted the 100 degree to negative 50.
I bet it could have.
Maybe.
I'd put money on that. Let's bet. Oh, goodness. All right. So those are our fun little weather apps. Let's move on to our next web app, which is iconfinder.net.
Icon Finder, it's simple. It's kind of like have the Google search engine look to it. You just kind of type in what you're looking for. And this app is very, very useful for someone that's making a website.
Yeah, there's a lot of cute icons in here.
And you just type in like arrow or something. Everybody needs an arrow on their site somewhere, right?
Yeah.
There's tons of them.
Yeah, and great quality. You can filter. You can have a bunch of icons per page. You can filter by color, like if you want the background color to be transparent or black, which is always nice because, I mean, when you're never with icons, generic icons, you're never going to get the specific background color you want. But usually it's like, do I have a dark background or do I have a light background or transparent? If you
can search by whether or not it's going to be commercial use or, you know, you have to.
Yeah, because a lot of them, they're just saying, if you want to just have this on your little fun, your own website, go ahead. But if you're going to be trying to make money off of it, then you need to filter by that.
So I just searched for commercial use, and I typed an arrow. I see all kinds of, like, you know, the download-looking arrows, or you can put next to a download link, you know.
Just generic arrows for, like, a line or something. Yeah.
And these, I mean, they look good. They don't look like a clip art-looking arrow or something. Like the
Internet Explorer arrows. Ooh, those are gorgeous. But yeah, there's a lot of places to find icons, but this is a good one. I've used this a couple times at work when I just need something because it's the fastest one I can remember to go to.
Wow. So I put in a heart because I was looking at the Firefox bar up here, looking kind of their icons for like favorites, and there's some interesting icons here.
Whoa, like hearts with cuts in them and stuff.
No, there's some very well-polished large ones, small ones. It's very useful.
Yeah. I mean, I would suggest anybody if you need icons. We've talked about in the past, haven't we, talked about other places to find icons?
Yeah, I think it was Icon Buffet we talked about. It was good, but you couldn't really search. It was kind of more of a, here's browser. A bunch of icons.
Yeah. And this one, it just, again.
They're both good.
These are, yeah. So, I mean, I would say as a web designer, like, or a web programmer, as I would say I am, I keep what I call, so I use X marks to synchronize my bookmarks across different installs of Firefox. And I have sort of like my programmer toolboxes. You know, I have a folder in my bookmarks called programming stuff where I just throw in all these little things like this. You know, there is no definitive icon searching website. Right. It just, you can't. Even if you do a Google image search, there's going to be images and stuff. And, you know, just there is no. So these are like good things to throw in there. So when you're looking for an icon, you go to one. If you don't find the one that just, you know, tickles your fancy, search at the next one and see if you can find it, or search them all and then pick from the best of all, you know, all the different websites that you want. So it's, you know, I'm not saying that this is the website that I will always go to search for icons, but throw it in your toolbox.
Yep.
The next web app that we're going to talk about is called Rolligator.
Rolligator.
What's Rolligator, Mark?
Rolligator is an app to where you can specify a few feeds and it's going to publicly display them. So like where you work, you've got some monitors on the wall where you could like, you know, what do I
Yeah, we have this giant 4x4, so 16, 24-inch Dell ultra-sharp monitors mounted on like a big giant wall together.
So like you can, I mean, they have all these different templates. You can have it full screened and everything. You can have them kind of like, as there's more feeds coming by, you can have them scroll across like it's like a news or like a stock ticker or something. And so throughout the day, like I know that at the university that we, you know, the University of Montana, at least in the business school, they have all these monitors all over the place playing like CNBC and things.
Yeah.
Well, you could put your own feed. Let's say the university had a business feed, an RSS feed. I'm sure they do. They could put that on here instead of having like some PowerPoint presentation just scrolling by all the time. And then they have to like have somebody go in there and like edit it and fix it up and update it like once a week or a day. Yeah. With this, they could just whenever they're making a new blog post or something, it just comes up, you know?
And yeah. So I went to the sample here and it's not working for me in Firefox in Linux. It like refreshes every 2 seconds. Which is a bummer. Got to check that stuff out. But from what I can see, it looks really pretty. It's nice. It's just an RSS feed of technology news from Yahoo. It's like a big screen. If I full screened it in Firefox, it would look good. It's got kind of a nice blue background.
So yours is not scrolling?
It starts to scroll. It gets like, you know, 5 pixels up. Oh, it just
Mine's going fine.
Check this out. Like it's like it starts and then it just kind of refreshes itself.
Oh, that is weird. So Jade's laptop can play sound, but mine can scroll a web page automatically, apparently.
Which would you rather have?
I think I'd go with the sound, but.
Okay. Well, yeah, I don't know.
It's working
for
me.
It could be a plugin or something I have, but it looks great. It's nice big text. It scrolls really smoothly. It's really pretty. Yeah, I like it. You know, I'm one of these weird people too. Like if I have a lot of computers with a lot of monitors attached to them, and sometimes I feel weird when one of my screens isn't doing something. So this could be something like I could throw on my iMac when I'm not doing face-off stuff to just have it scroll news items. but be careful, burn in.
But this, well, it's moving though. So.
Well, yeah, but the background,
it's true,
and the edges and stuff. But
a lot of the TVs that are on public display are usually LCD and don't really have as much of a problem with the burn in. But yeah, like this is perfect for, let's say, the university where I'm in that situation where you have a public display of a monitor or something, and you're looking for something to put on it. But I mean, when I went to school, they had PowerPoint. And they were updating every once in a while. Yeah. So
actually, mine had this really weird program that embedded like CNBC and then a PowerPoint. Okay. And it did like stock ticking on the side because it was a college of business. Yeah. And it was great.
They were working on stuff.
It was
that
up on like the fourth floor where all like the older students were, and there's like couches there. So when we like were waiting for classes, because like classes would sometimes go over, it was so nice to just sit and veg out in front of a TV and watch like some business news and on CNBC and stuff. It was great.
And I mean, and this you can add whatever feed you want. So
or like let's say here's a great example. Let's say you have you get an extra screen, a big one in your office. And you're a company that's doing work in shipping or something like that. Mm-hmm. You do a Twitter search RSS on shipping.
Yeah.
It's just, you know, it's not really super, it's not relevant, but I mean, it's relevant. It's not critical.
You might see something that catches your eye and be like, well, we need to check that out.
Yeah, exactly. So when your employees are just kind of, you know, if they take like breaks or something, they're, you know, look up there and see what the whole thought on shipping is in Twitter or something, you know, that's a great idea.
Or you could have some kind of an internal feed that you're keeping an eye on something, maybe alerts, company-wide alerts,
news
or
alerts.
Something.
Yeah, totally.
So it's pretty cool. It makes it. I mean, you could obviously do this yourself and make something up, but this is easy.
It's cute.
Makes it easy.
They've done it for you. Yeah, exactly. Bookmark it, set to your home. So that was Rolligator. I want to remind you guys. This is a great time because we've had news and follow-ups. And next week, we're going to have some web apps that were actually submitted by users. So if you guys want to submit some news and follow-ups or web apps or even just an idea for a topic that you want us to talk about, go to faceoffshow.com/feedback and let us know. Okay, so let's get into our topics. The first topic that we want to talk about is the Definitive Guide to HT Access Techniques, the do's and don'ts. And we've heard do's and don'ts before because we
like do's and don'ts. Yeah.
So what is HT Access?
HT Access is so it goes back to the whole the hosting issue. We talked about hosting in a previous episode, a recent previous episode. Okay, so.
Continue, please.
If you're on a shared host, you can't modify the settings for everyone in where you would normally do it, which would be the Apache configuration file.
And this is HT Access exclusive to Apache?
It's exclusive. Yes, it is. Okay. Well, I mean, other they might try to implement. They were the ones.
Okay. Yeah. So I mean,
the other ones have similar things, but the HT Access is for Apache.
There's a lot of web servers out there. Let's say even in Ruby, there's Mongrel, Webbrick. In Java, there's I was just playing with one.
Tomcat.
There's Tomcat, and then there's another one that like you can use with Persevere, which we'll use at work. But a lot of them, I mean, Apache has been around. Apache kind of revolutionized websites in general because before it was sort of like you had one server with one web server on it, and it could host one website. And Apache sort of really revolutionized it by making it so you can serve multiple web addresses off one server.
Yeah, they call it like virtual host or virtual... Yeah, virtual host, I think it's called. Yep.
So, but like you said, if you have 100 or whatever websites off one server and they want to change something, you can't change the Apache.com
for everyone.
For all of them because it just doesn't work.
Right.
So HT Access, if it's enabled in the Apache Conf, allows you to override and change some of the settings that are set in the Apache Conf for just your website.
It actually goes further than that. It actually will allow you to make changes per folder.
Oh, wow.
On the website. So, like, you could have one folder that's got a password. You know, if you go to this directory, it's password protected for this whole directory structure, but down here, it's not, you know. So, you can set settings per folder.
Yeah. So a lot of things are done, like, sort of, if mod rewrite is enabled in Apache, you set all your sort of URL rewriting rules for PHP and things like that in HT Access.
So, typically, users that are on shared hosts don't want to be bothered, and they don't really know typically how to run a web server. And so a lot of times they'll go on the web and, you know, they'll find a snippet or something and they'll copy and paste it and it works, but they don't understand how it works or why. And this is why, this is how we've come to this do's and don'ts. I mean, there's some things you just don't do, and there's some great uses of HTAccess. You have to use it actually if you're on a shared host. Mm-hmm. You want to do some of the more advanced stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. Like you said, a lot of times you just get a snippet and it works, but do you really know what you just did? Do you know that maybe to enable this one thing that allows you to do something, you left a giant security hole or something elsewhere? So number one is create custom error pages. We'll link to the article, which has all the code snippets that you're going to want to do for these in your HTAccess file. Mm-hmm. But basically, this just tells HTAccess error document for a 401 error is this file.
Yep.
And this is absolutely essential.
To please everybody, I guess, the default is probably just to do an actual error, just a regular 401 error page. And this allows you to make a custom one, which looks a little bit better. You can actually give the user something that's useful that says, hey, you know, we noticed you searched for this, but it doesn't actually exist, but you might be interested in this, this, and this.
Exactly. So, like for a 404, which means not found, it's great to put like a Google custom site search in your 404 page so that you're like, hey, this isn't what, but maybe you should search my site for it because maybe just the address is wrong. Make it useful. A lot of websites make them really fun and cute so that if you get a 404, oftentimes you're pretty teed off. You're like, because you're looking for something and you're like, well, great, this isn't here.
Somebody linked to something that you used to have in the past. And
so like if you have like the Twitter 404 is that, you know, a little bird, it softens the edges of being mad of not finding content. You're like, okay.
Or is it the owl?
Is it the owl? I think the bird is 404, but I could be wrong. Or same thing like a 500 with PHP. A lot of times a 500, because it might actually give away part of your code, which could be a security concern. The default 500, so make your own. So a 500 is a great example of an internal server error, which usually means your code is wrong somehow.
Yep.
To say specifically on a 500, let me know that you got this. You know, report this 500 so I can fix it.
A lot of times websites, you know, try to make it funny, ease a little of the tension because it's, you know, the server side had a little error, but, you know, so there's all kinds of funny little error pages.
Like, hey, I screwed up.
I spilled the coffee on the server or something.
Yeah, exactly. So get those done.
This one's funny. Application error, we blame Dan. This is funny. It eases the tension a little bit.
I blame at Mark Sanborn for everything. It works.
Number two is prevent directory browsing.
Yeah. You got to do this because people are really clever, and even if they can sort of get to one of your deep folders and browse it, then they
it just
can
reveals.
Maybe, it reveals more than you want to. Exactly. Yeah. And that way you don't have to go put an index.html in every folder so that they can't browse it. You just turn it off right away and it just says directory browsing not allowed.
Number three, I'm not sure if I agree with this. So this one is you just mentioned it. Typically, it's index.html or PHP. You can actually change that to anything you want. Yeah.
I think you might want to on this website to prevent any sort of hacking or scripting attack where if somehow they got into your server and put in an index. Because most of them default to index.html. So if you have an index.php and someone gets access to your file system and puts an index.html, then they've taken over your website effectively.
Okay.
If they were smart, they would just replace your index.php. But a lot of these script kiddies, you know, they'll just put an index.html in every folder that has, you know, links to ads.
So if you have some kind of vulnerability already, I don't know. See, I look at this as a developer standpoint, and I'm like, why is this page loading? And so I throw an index.php, and it's not coming up on the screen. I'm like, what's going on?
Yeah.
You know, like let's say it's the news folder and you got news.html instead of index.html. As a developer, you might put in an index and be like, what's going on? Or maybe you're looking for that page.
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe it also.
I don't know. What do you think?
I think you could also use this maybe in HTAccess. You can set stuff for specific folders. So let's say in my root folder, I have index.php, news.php, members.php. I could say it's a way to kind of do routes, right? You could say for this folder, I want the default page to be ./news.php.
Okay.
You could do that too.
Yep. In the past, what I've done with that one is made it in index and then made a require and required the other page.
Yeah.
But yeah, this would be a way to do that,
I guess. That's a way to do it. Yeah.
Number four is set up a 301 direct. Absolutely. 301s.
We talk about this all the time.
A 301 is a way to tell people, hey, this URL is no longer here. It's over here permanently, forever.
Yep. It tells people, it tells search engines, it tells bots. It's very important.
Yeah. The biggest difference is like Google, when they go to this URL and goes in it, 301 is the other one. They say, oh, we should transfer everything we know about this URL to this one. Mm-hmm. So you get to permanently move the SEO, all that.
Yep.
So it's a very good thing to do. Another common thing people do with 301 to redirects is to redirect like pages that aren't there anymore, but people are still linking to them, so they can still get that page rank. Another reason would be to automatically redirect from an http:// domain to http:// www domain, just to keep it consistent.
Cool.
So,
yeah, and you just need to know it. You need to know 301s. They're important. We talk about them a lot. Number five is compress file output with gzip.
So gzip is a really, really fast compression. It's not the best, but it's very, very, very fast, mm-hmm. and it does a very good job with especially text-based stuff. Mm-hmm. And so it's often used in web development, and it can make the pages load way faster, because mm-hmm. usually the slowest link is between you and the server or the database. Mm-hmm. But that's one of the common slowdowns. And so gzip can, you know, drastically decrease the page load.
Is there any implications of using this with things like mobile browsers? Like, I mean, I'm assuming that, like, the iPod Touch browser is advanced enough to do this. But, I mean, I don't like a Windows Mobile phone that's kind of older.
Doesn't have as much processing power.
Yeah, or, I mean, even I'm not worried about processing power, but I'm wondering if it has the ability to. Like, what if my browser doesn't have the ability to do gzip, or do they just all? Is it just assumed?
I think if it doesn't have the ability to do gzip, it doesn't send back.
It compressed. Oh, okay. Yeah. Cool. Save. So like, we talk about this optimizing sometimes, and that's just a way, if you're looking for something to do, to go on and turn that on and optimize some stuff a little bit.
That's a good question, though. We should probably look into that. I know I enabled it on my site, and I noticed a big difference, actually.
Really?
Yeah.
Great.
It yeah, like half this time.
Wow, that's amazing.
At least it seemed. I didn't do any like.
Are we having some bro science here? It sounds like it was.
It wasn't a formal test.
It was at least 12 times faster. Easy.
Number six.
If we can, before I want to go back to that. Whether or not, I mean, it's bro science or not, physically your files being sent across the internet are going to be smaller. There is a difference. Whether or not it's super noticeable, you might as well do it anyways.
Yeah.
Number six is redirect to a secure HTTPS connection. This is really important.
Yeah, so if somebody goes to like shop or secure.yournodomain, those domains usually, I mean, if it's secure.yournodomain, you're typically going to be expecting an HTTPS. Yeah. Why not just automatically force them? If they go to the regular HTTP, it just forces them to HTTPS.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You don't always want to do that, but you need to... It's a very common thing to do, so learn how to do it.
And what it does is absolutely prevents them from going to HTTP and doing that stuff. So their data is absolutely secure. It removes the human error element of them doing that.
Yep. And somebody like mislinks. They meant to link to HTTPS, but they didn't, and then
And it doesn't affect the user. They don't go there and go like, why isn't there a lock? It just forwards them to the HTTPS version, and they're good to go.
Yep.
Number seven is block script execution.
So if your site is typically PHP and, you know, you're not expecting some CGI or some JSP or Python file or a Perl file, turn them off. It's just an added, you know, there's a lot of, you know, I looked at my log. My site was, I had one of my sites that I launched, you know, and it was only up for a week, and I looked in the logs and there's all kinds of attacks going on. They're literally bots and crawlers going out there just trying everything they can possibly try. And if they find an opening, they're immediately trying to execute scripts if they can upload it to it. So if you can turn them off, it's just an added layer of security.
Yeah. Or even, again, it's the kind of we talked about before, it's damage control if you are compromised. If somehow it compromises and they're uploading just even an HTM file that you're not using. You know, your site's pure, absolute PHP.
Right.
You know, disable that so that if they do put, again, like an index.htm, which Apache will look at first, if you don't, you know, then it doesn't matter. You'll be okay. It won't even do it.
Yeah.
Or if they embed PHP into an HTM file, because you can take an HTM file and put, you know, the PHP tags, and as long as you specify PHP, it'll still be parsed as PHP if your Apache configuration allows for parsing of different files. And this is a way to disable that.
So sometimes when you offer a file that may appear to be a text file, or maybe it's an MP3 or a movie file, but some browsers, you know, when you try to link to it, or, you know, like, let's say it's in your web directory and you try to link to it, sometimes the browser will actually try to open it as text.
Yeah.
And there's a way in htaccess to say these types of extensions, I always want you to send those as like binary type files, not text.
Stupid QuickTime does this.
Does it?
You're like, for some reason, and I avoid it like the plague, I end up always having to install QuickTime on my machines. And then anytime you click an MP3 file or any sort of audio file, it just plays it right in the browser. Like, you go to download a podcast and you just want to click it and download, it starts playing it every time. Mm. This is a way to force it. Actually, I'm not sure if that'll fix this.
Yeah, I think this is mainly for like,
let's like say CSV. Like, if you click CSV, your browser, by default, yeah, I think we'll try to open it.
It's text.
But this is a way you say, no, I want you to send this as an octet stream. And it goes, oh, that's just not regular web data. That's stuff that you need to save.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Number 9 is restrict file upload limits for PHP.
Yeah, you might have this in your apps or something, but as well, you should set it as a hard value that the web server will just... you know, reject if you, and I mean, this is oftentimes, I mean, if you're expecting an image and somebody's uploading like a 20 megabyte file, it's probably not an image. And
well, yeah. Or, I mean, a lot of servers set it, really, really, really low, like, you know, 500K or there's like a 10 second script execution time before it times out. And, you know, just sometimes you just might want to up that as well. So let's say,
that's true.
Number 10 is enable file caching.
Caching. So what is caching? Let's just get that out of the way.
Well, caching basically, I'm trying to figure out how to say it the best way. It just does stuff ahead. It does stuff and keeps it ready and doesn't re-execute it or redo it.
The way I was thinking of it is it takes something that's normally dynamic and makes like a snapshot of it and then serves that snapshot.
It serves that snapshot, Moneypenny, and I want that snapshot back.
It saves it, and then anybody that requests it within that time period gets that one, and they don't get the real time up to the second one.
So like if you're caching, you know, like a web page, it processes it once and then has it cached. So the next person that goes to that web page, it doesn't have to reprocess all that crap again. It just sends it that snapshot.
This is almost always the go-to first step in making a website faster is caching because I mean, it can tenfold the amount of visitors you can take.
Yeah, we've talked about this WP Super Cache plugin for WordPress. It makes your website diggable.
Yeah, well, it's basically saying. It's basically not running the PHP. It's running PHP once per hour, let's say, versus once every time a user comes.
Yeah.
It's a drastic difference.
Yeah. So this is a way to enable it. It's really important for things like CSS, JavaScript. They're not going to change.
And this is a way, I mean, as far as I know, I think this is the way to do it through Apache. There's different ways. Memcache, I think it's called.
Yeah.
Ruby has its own, doesn't it? Or does...
I'm assuming Rails will do it for you.
There's a static way where you can actually point your PHP points to a .html file.
Oh, wow.
Based on the time. There's a bunch of different ways of doing this. And this is the way to do it in the htaccess. So.
Number 11 is protect your site from hotlinking.
I need to do this, actually.
Yeah, we've talked about this before. So hotlinking is where, let's say I have, you know, an image that's stored on jaderobbins.com, and in my article, we're all over the place today, my article on jaderobbins.com, I have images from jaderobbins.com. But let's say you're at marksanmore.com, and you say, wow, that's a cool image, jaderobbins.com. And in your article, you link to my image at jdrobbins.com. That's a hot link. And Apache is smart enough to see where that request is coming from. So it sees that Mark Sanborn is requesting an image from jdrobbins.com, and you can tell it to not do that. Mm. You've seen this a lot. You need to do this with NixTutor because people are stealing your content. And not only are they stealing your content, they're still hot linking to your images and using your bandwidth.
So when somebody goes to their site, they're seeing my content, and I'm paying for it.
Yeah, so remove hot linking. I mean, unless you specifically have a website or a service that you feel like you want to allow hot linking, maybe.
Maybe if you have like an affiliate program and you have like a banner or something that you allow people to have out, make sure that is still able to be hot linked.
Yeah. But, or maybe you're an artist and you have pictures or something up and you want to specifically see when people are hotlinking to your stuff. You know, you want to see when other people are using it, then you might. But for the most part, you don't need to.
Yeah. A lot. Typically, they tend to disable it.
Yeah.
Because even, I mean, let's say you do like one of the images or something, and it's not copywritten. You can you can save it and put it up on your own site and use your own bandwidth. Why?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Just don't. Yeah. There's no reason.
Hot link.
So yeah. So
and it protects you too, because you don't have. What if they change the image or it's gone? Then your article breaks.
Yeah.
That's
a lot of people do when people steal images from them. You put up like an image that says like, "Quit stealing my pictures, jerk."
Yeah.
You know, and then. But another time too, what I've seen happen is someone will steal an image from a website that isn't, you know, they're using pretty basic hosting and it gets really popular on something like Dig or you know, Facebook or something. And that website goes down because someone just hot linked an image from them and they weren't ready for that huge traffic spike.
Yep. So disable it. If you don't have, I mean, if you don't have a specific reason not to disable it.
Number 12 is disguise your file types. You can disguise all of your file types by making them appear as PHP files. Wow, that's pretty handy.
Yeah, I don't know if I would disguise it as PHP. I mean, I've noticed, and there's different ways to do this. You can do a mod rewrite and make everything look like a .html, even though it's a Python, Perl, or PHP or whatever.
Yep.
I mean, it's obscurity a little bit. I mean, if somebody knows you're running PHP, they kind of know what to kind of attack, go for, versus if you're like a, you know, I don't know, Perl CGI guy or something.
Again, hide any information that might help someone try to break in or exploit your website as much as you can. I mean, why not?
Yeah.
All right. So now the mistakes and the don'ts. Those were the do's. Those are good things to know. The first sort of mistake is be careful of spelling. And the article says bluntly, htaccess is not forgiving of spelling errors.
Not and at it's all.
I've done this.
Especially with like rewrites and like regular expressions and things.
Yeah.
You could literally accidentally redirect your entire site to somewhere else and you, just by one key difference of a
character. I have. If you break it too and it doesn't like your configuration, it just flat out will say like, oh, your configuration's broken. I don't like it. And you could break your whole website.
Yeah.
Have done. Don't want to do again.
htaccess, like many Linux, Unix type files, are case sensitive.
Yep. So if you're having, if you're noticing that you broke something, one thing you might want to look at is caps. So like, you know, especially in the sort of the tags where you're discussing things, they do sort of a camel case. You have to make sure you follow that sort of convention.
Caching, you know, as a programmer, it's kind of annoying because you'll save something and be like, why isn't it working?
Yeah,
we've be careful that. With that a little bit, yeah. You know. Another thing is sometimes people will accidentally cache something for way too long.
Yeah.
And then they'll make a change and they'll be like, oh, you know, I added this new product or something and why aren't people clicking on it and checking it out? Well, exactly. Because they're not seeing it because their browser still thinks the page is the same because of the cache. So
exactly.
Got to watch out for stuff like that.
Or if you set a cache that's too small, what's the point?
That's
why
true
are you
too,
why are you setting a cache if you're going to send it for 2 seconds?
No. Don't forget to comment out your notes within the file. You can, you know, if you're going to make some 301 and you come back later on and be like, why is this here? I'm going to just delete it. And then it was holding your website up.
Or, use a pound or a hash mark is how you comment in htaccess.
Just like, you know, if you're programming, comment.
Always. The next one is always test your site. Again, and I would even say if you're having trouble, start testing it on multiple computers because htaccess sometimes can be a unforgiving mistress. So make sure you test it. Make sure, you know, if you do change your caching, try and make sure it actually is caching. You did it right. If you enabled caching, like you said earlier, and you know, you changed something on your website, make sure it's showing up because your cache may be preventing other people from seeing it.
Due to the nature of the htaccess, it can sometimes be like the glue that's holding your website together. You know, back it up.
Yeah. Oh, totally. Always .htaccess.backup always before you make a big change. Definitely.
And maybe save it offsite or something.
Make sure that your htaccess stuff you're doing is cross browser compatible. There can be some issues. I don't know. Some browsers maybe get weird about if a file is .php and it's not.
They're giving an example of like when you certain methods of forcing a file download, like that one we were talking about, the save as.
Okay.
Sometimes you could like the QuickTime thing. I don't know. There could be something like that where it's trying to do it in the browser and you tell it no and it doesn't know what to do.
Definitely. Like look at your MIME types for things like that. So the next one is, remember when you're protecting a web directory with htaccess, which a lot of people do, it's a really simple way to authenticate a page, that if you should be using HTTPS.
Yeah, because, like, you know, HTTP is in plain text. HTTPS is kind of encrypted. Mm-hmm. So anything that you send over HTTPS, like a password, can be potentially sniffed by somebody that's on your network or someone around you. So.
Yeah, so if you're really trying to do important authentication,
even
within an app, not just with htaccess, make sure you use HTTPS. It's confusing because a lot of people think, well, I don't want to have to go buy an expensive cert, If you're doing only internal stuff,
you can just
self-sign and it's encrypted, then it's just the problem is browsers will complain, so you don't want to use it on public stuff where you have customers or anything. But if it's all internal, do use your own self-sign cert.
And I've seen people say, oh, if you self-sign, it's not secure. Yeah, it's all secure. The only difference is you're not verified between the two.
Your browser doesn't know that the company that issued the certification, is a company that is trusted to do certification.
Only difference, it still protects against man in the middle because you still have the public key, private key combination. You still have the encryption. It's still safe. It's just you don't know that this is the real PayPal or this is the real. Exactly.
So if you're doing it for internal stuff, it doesn't matter because you're like, I trust my company because I did it.
But if it's going to be public, you have to buy a cert. I mean, it's just the way it is.
Yeah, because any sort of basic user, you can't explain to them that they need to go in and add an exception.
Yeah, no.
It's just ridiculous.
So, actually, htaccess is a very good way to do a password, though, because it's already been tested, and there's sometimes they'll find an error with it, but then they'll fix it up. And so it's a good way. I mean, if you do need password protect a portion of your site and you don't really know how to write
without
it
any
PHP
code.
Or something,
if you don't want, you can do it without
code.
It's
real simple, easy, and it's secure.
Absolutely.
They use it all the time, all over the place.
Absolutely. All right. Well, that wraps it up for this episode of Face Off Show. I want to remind you guys that you can subscribe to the show by going to faceoffshow.com/subscribe. And if you've done that already, thank you. We appreciate it. You can also give us feedback for the show, like I said earlier, if you want to suggest anything we talk about or correct us if we're wrong, or just even want to tell us, good job, bad job, go to faceoffshow.com/feedback. We always appreciate any feedback we get. Thank you again.
You can also give us a call at 31Web2Tech.
Yeah, that's a great way to give us feedback is through our telephone number, 31Web2Tech. Also, if you can, go into iTunes and leave us a review. That's a big way to get the word out about the show and let us know. And anyway, we really appreciate it, guys, and we'll see you next week.